Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and you're listening to The Takeaway. We're going to end on a playful note by talking about something that's a good fit for those spending a lot of time indoors hoping to find some inner peace. We're talking about jigsaw puzzles, which, like toilet paper and Clorox wipes, have been flying off the shelves. So much so that puzzle manufacturers are having a hard time keeping up with consumer demand. In the last 2 weeks of March, one of the world's largest puzzle manufacturers, Ravensburger, saw sales go up 370% in North America compared to the same time last year.
Hi, this is Jerry Lynn from Bedford, Texas in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I've put together a 300-piece puzzle, five 500-piece puzzles, and a 600-piece puzzle, and we are building ourselves back up to the 1,000-piece puzzles that are still lurking in our closet.
For those of us sheltering in place, the appeal of puzzles isn't all that puzzling. Whether you're starting small with 100 pieces or dreaming big with 1,000, puzzles are a safe way to socially distance that doesn't involve Netflix. For more on the popularity of puzzles, we turn to someone who spends a lot more time thinking about them than the rest of us. Chris Byrne is a toy historian and consultant with thetoyguy.com. I asked Chris about the history of puzzles, specifically when we first saw the jigsaw puzzle as we know it today.
The first jigsaw puzzles were in the 18th century, around 1766. A cartographer by the name of John Salisbury cut up a map of Europe and pasted it to a board, cut it up, and used it to teach geography to his students.
And then what came after that? How did the puzzles evolve in the 20th century?
Back in 1908, puzzles were one of the hottest things for Christmas, and that was a time when people didn't give gifts quite in the same way that we do today. It was more traditional to give somebody a card to celebrate Christmas. So there were at-home puzzle making kits, so you could take those cards and cut them up and put them together as a puzzle. So it was sort of like a double gift, and those were quite the rage in 1908. Fast forward to the 30s and the Depression, and we started to see the more die-cut puzzles like we know today. During World War II, when people had to be in blackout, puzzles were very popular. And they've really stayed popular throughout the years. There was another bump in the 60s when Springbok puzzles came out with the first licensed puzzles with popular characters, Mickey Mouse and Snoopy and all of those. And then the 80s with the home game boom, really touched off by Trivial Pursuit in 83, we started to see a lot more puzzles around, and they've really never gone away.
Video games and the internet didn't suppress the popularity of puzzles at all?
Not at all. And I think the reason is that they were always sort of a small sector of the toy industry, but it's a very different experience. Sitting around a table with friends or by yourself doing a puzzle and being quiet is very different from, you know, trying to get Mario through the most complicated track.
So now what explains the current resurgence of puzzles in popular culture? In my house, because of our social isolation due to coronavirus, we finally pulled a cat puzzle off our shelf from the company Puzzles So Hard, and it is so hard, by the way, but very rewarding. Are we seeing a resurgence in puzzle popularity because of this pandemic, or did it start to creep up even before then?
Well, I think it's definitely been because of the pandemic that we've seen such a big spike in recent months. And I think it's for a lot of reasons. It's something that people can do together. It's not competitive like a board game. It's something you can do a little bit of and then walk away. So I think it's mm-hmm. It's kind of an ongoing activity that people enjoy, and it's very relaxing.
Because it's slow. It is slow fun, right?
It's slow. And you know, when you are sitting there going, I need that corner of the barn, or I need that cloud, or I need this thing, you're not really thinking about anything else. So it really does make it possible for you to take a little mental break from all the other things you might be worrying about at the time.
I'm wondering what social media has meant for the puzzle world. I've been seeing a little bit on Instagram and TikTok, people showing off puzzles.
It's kind of along the lines of showing off the dinner you made, or showing off anything that says I did something. And it's a way of reaching out to other people and staying connected. And I think that's one of the most important things that we've seen in this coronavirus world, has been the need for people to stay connected through their activities. And that's happening virtually.
So what makes a good puzzle? What are the ones that are quite popular, and is there a particular reason that makes them popular and good?
Well, it starts with the image. It absolutely starts with the image and the quality of the image, and it has to certainly be one that appeals to you. You want to be able to spend several hours looking at this picture and having it come together. I also think that because it's a tactile process as well, a really nice quality cardboard that feels good when you like push that piece in place, I think that's important as well. And you're holding the little pieces in your hand and turning them around. There's that tactile satisfaction as well that I think is really important.
Are there strategies that you'd recommend for people who are new to puzzling? I mean, for me, how do you start a 1,000-piece puzzle? I told you I was working on this puzzle from Puzzle So Hard, and I think the first thing that we did was try to get the edges right in the corners. Is that considered the appropriate strategy?
Yes, I think you want to sort of lay that out. I would tell anybody who is very brand new to puzzling, something's called Puzzle So Hard might not be where you want to start. But I always say look for an image that is really well defined in kind of blocks of color or blocks of photography. So you're not trying to get, 87 different tulips that are all identical all at once, because that can be frustrating. And start with a smaller puzzle piece. Start with a 300-piece puzzle, a 500. Work up to the 1,000-piece puzzle, or then the 40,000-piece puzzle that Ravensburger introduced at Toy Fair this year.
Wow, 40,000. That is intense. Before we let you go, I was wondering if you think our renewed interest in activities like puzzling will make us rethink maybe how we spend our time and how time moves after this pandemic is over.
I certainly hope so. And I think that it really is a wonderful alternative to the screen, because just physiologically, it's a lot more restful to look at a puzzle and to socialize around a puzzle than to watch that constantly moving screen, even if we don't see it as moving. I do think that if we slow down and take the time to connect around that, and we've learned that, we will get through this, and that time to connect and have a shared activity, I think is something that's hugely important for individuals and families and groups of people.
Chris Byrne is a toy historian and consultant with thetoyguide.com. Chris, thanks for joining us, and happy puzzling.
Thank you. Same to you.
Many of you told us you're puzzling or taking up other hobbies while sheltering in place.
Hello, this is Barbara calling from Red Bluff, California. I am just keeping with my baking habit and trying to step it up. And I have been able to transfer my anxiety about coronavirus to my anxiety about flour. Who is buying all the flour?
I've been crafting with my 9-year-old. We've been catching up on all those birthday and Christmas craft kits, painting, sewing, pottery, drawing, jewelry, slime making, you name it.
Whatever you're doing at home during this time, we're grateful that listening to The Takeaway has been a part of it. Before we go, a quick shout out to the team that makes this show with a lot of hard work and a lot of heart every week. Our producing team is Ethan Oberman, Jackie Martin, Meg Dalton, Patricia Jacob, Amber Hall, Jason Tureski, and Lydia McMullen-Laird. Our senior producer is Alexander Boti. Polly Arungu is our digital editor. Jose Olivares is line producing, and Katarina Barton is our intern. David Gable is our executive assistant. Lee Hill is our executive producer. Our director this week was Vince Fairchild, alongside engineer Debbie Daughtry. And we had a big remote assist from director Jay Cowett. From all of us, we appreciate you listening every day. I'm Matt Katz. Lizzie O'Leary is back with you next week. Stay well. This is The Takeaway.